This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. In July 1973, Alexander Butterfield, the deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon, appeared before the Senate Watergate Committee.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
The Nixon tapes set off the modern struggle over presidential records that continues to this day, and they inspired record-keeping rules that the Trump administration has repeatedly defied. President Trump is known for tearing up documents that he's legally required to preserve, leaving records analysts no choice but to tape the pieces back together like a jigsaw puzzle. With the end of Trump's presidency looming, what will be saved and what will be lost? Tom Blanton is the director of the National Security Archive, a nonprofit government watchdog. Tom, it's great to have you.
Nice to be with you, Jen.
Also with us is Richard Ovenden. He's the director of the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford. He's also author of Burning the Books, A History of the Deliberate Destruction of Knowledge. Richard, welcome.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So, Tom, first, tell us about the federal laws that regulate what information will be or should be saved from the Trump administration's time in power.
Well, the Presidential Records Act really was, as you said, a post-Watergate reform that said to all the before that, presidents had treated their records just as their personal property, and they had really some tragedies and losses and burns and destructions. And the Congress said in 1978, no, the records belong to the people. We've got to set up a legal system for saving them. I think the problem with the Presidential Records Act is that it's an honor system, in effect, and it gives a lot of authority. One judge in one of our lawsuits said practically unfettered authority to the president. So even though the law says if it's got historical or evidentiary or legal or administrative value, it has to be saved, the presidents have had real trouble, from Ronald Reagan to George H.W. Bush to Clinton to this current president, making sure those records get saved for posterity.
How are the records preserved, and who's responsible for them?
Most records nowadays are created digitally, as you can imagine, on computers and email systems and text systems. And so the great reform, I think, of the last 5 years has been a success story from years and years of litigation. I mean, we sued Ronald Reagan to try to force him to save the White House backup tapes for email. And now, 30, 35 years later, there's automated systems that make multiple copies. And those get handed off to the National Archives of the United States on the day the new president is sworn in, on January 20th. So The good news is that so much is automatically saved. I think the bad news is we know from press reports and insider accounts that a lot of records have not survived to this day, disappearing instant text messages, for example, in the Trump White House, or the five meetings with the Russian president that never got written down by the American side. Even one time, President Trump grabbed his interpreter's notebook away from her so no record would be kept. So we've got some records have already disappeared, but a vast, we're talking hundreds of millions, if not a billion, electronic records have been automatically saved.
Richard, how do U.S. laws compare to laws in other countries, specifically around the record-keeping of leaders?
Well, I think if you take the United Kingdom, for example, we have the Public Records Act 1958, which is not specifically around the records kept by our prime ministers. We have a very, very different system for those than is in the United States. In some ways, an inferior system, I think. But the 1958 Public Records Act is kind of format neutral in the sense that it requires, civil servants and anybody inside government to apply record-keeping practices which are there to ensure the transparency of decision-making and public policy setting. And they are administered through Parliament and through the system of archival record keeping that is a balance between the National Archives of the United Kingdom, which is the ultimate destination for anything that it needs to be kept for historical purposes, and the record centres in the main government departments, including the Cabinet Office, where the Prime Minister's own papers would be kept. So the system in theory should kind of parallel what happens in the United States, and it's certainly meant to cover electronic records and the electronic systems like email and so on that government uses in order to do its business. But just the same as in the United States, we have a similar problem, which is that there's been, because of the desire to avoid disclosure of information that's managed through the record keeping processes, people have been moving to these commercial messaging systems like Signal or Telegram, even Snapchat, so that are either encrypted or that auto delete. And this is really fundamentally changing the way that civil servants, special advisors, government ministers behave in order to evade that whole process that these systems like the Presidential Records Act, like the Public Records Act in the United Kingdom, been designed there to make sure that there's integrity in government, that there's transparency in decision making.
Well, Tom, when we talk about, you know, automatically deleting messages, or, you know, the president taking an interpreter's notebook from him or her, are those legal actions under the Presidential Records Act?
They're not legal. And the White House Counsel's Office actually sent around two different times in 2017 a prohibiting memo to all the White House staff. You can't use those kind of apps unless you do a screenshot of the message and move it over into an official email system. You're prohibited from using those kinds of techniques unless you, for official business, unless you save it. And Congress actually put that into the law in 2018. The problem, we know, is folks at the Trump White House kept doing it. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, used WhatsApp, for example, to communicate with the Saudi Arabian prince who had killed the journalist Khashoggi. So the bad behavior kept going, and I think that's one of the real issues with the Presidential Records Act. In our system, it's based on faith that a president would want to save his or her history. And I think with this president, we've seen a different kind of behavior. His own White House counsel, Don McGahn, described being reprimanded by President Trump. What are you doing there scribbling? What are you doing taking notes? I never had a lawyer who took notes. So it's a little bit more mafia style than any kind of presidency we've had before.
Richard, how do you see President Trump's behavior and his administration's lack of record keeping fitting in with this conversation about the destruction of knowledge throughout history?
Well, unfortunately, there is a very long history of this kind of behavior. And, you know, we've got plenty of examples. I talk about them in my book of states trying to destroy other states' knowledge, if you like, to weaken their, you know, to weaken their ability to govern, or their weaken their ability to administer their country. And, you know, there's a classic example in American history, which is not my country's finest hour, of course, 1814, when a British expeditionary force besieged Washington and burned the Library of Congress. And this was a, you know, obviously an incredibly hostile act intended to weaken the ability of the American nation to govern itself. And there are kind of numerous examples of that throughout history. When it comes into the kind of personal domain, I think there are there are particular 20th century moments where this has been of critical importance, which affects, you know, individuals' lives today. And I think that's particularly true when many of the European powers moved out of former colonies, gave independence to nations which had been part of their world empires, and that's particularly true for Britain, for France, in Algeria, for example, for the Dutch in East Asia. And at that moment, instead of handing over records of the colonial administrations to the new national archives of new countries, colonial administrators destroyed records to hide their either their misdemeanors, their acts of corruption or racist behavior. Or sometimes it was just a desire to be kind of tidy, you know, let's not leave all these papers floating around. But I think mostly it's actually to obstruct history in a sense. And I think that's what is most troubling about what's happening in your country with the Trump administration. The similar things are happening in the UK at the moment, which is this ability, this desire to avoid the judgment of history, whether that's to avoid immediate kind of legal action or through the Freedom of Information Acts in the UK or the US, or I think almost that's even worse in my mind is to avoid the judgment of future history. And I think that's where standards of behaviour in public life need to be re-examined, and those kinds of standards need to be reinserted. And I think this sense that we need to have kind of probity and moral standards in public life need to be reinserted at the heart of Western democracies again.
Tom, President Trump isn't the first to rip up documents, literally or figuratively. Give us a bit more insight into how past presidents have preserved or not preserved their records.
Well, we've had quite a run since the Presidential Records Act went into effect in 1978. I mean, the last day of the Reagan administration, I was in a federal courtroom as we sought an injunction to save the backup tapes of the email system that had been in effect in the White House. And the last day of the George H.W. Bush administration, a bunch of career staff and archivists were in the White House literally tossing hard drives into cardboard boxes for what one of them later testified in our court case was a midnight ride to take the files back to Texas. And at the end of the George W. Bush administration, it turned out about 22 million emails had gone missing because they had upgraded the automatic system and someone, a whistleblower, said, it doesn't save it automatically anymore, and they didn't fix it. So the Obama folks, we had to sue the Obama folks, and to their credit, they settled that case. They restored the backup tapes. They did searches to restore those missing emails. They published their visitor logs of who came to the White House to lobby the staff. And what's amazing to me, I think now we know from cases that my little non-governmental organization has brought together with historians like the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations, that the Trump White House ordered the Secret Service not to track the visitors who came to Mar-a-Lago. So you have whole categories of records like that that just were never created, were never kept, and that will be a hole in the history forever.
But what I hear you saying is that the Presidential Records Act doesn't have the kind of teeth it needs to properly enforce these rules. What change is needed to ensure presidencies are accurately documented?
You're absolutely right. The Act has a lot of gums and no teeth. So it gets a little slobbery, I guess, is the metaphor, if you want to really carry that out. I think the law has to restore the National Archives of the United States to a far more prominent and activist and watchdog and audit position. the National Archives is kind of an orphan agency in our system. Its total budget, I think Jill Lepore, the historian in New York Magazine, compared it to a single C-17 Air Force transport plane is the equivalent of the total budget of our National Archives, which is charged with all this preservation and this tsunami of electronic records that are being created and that the National Archives has to preserve. So we've argued in court, and the judges have on the one hand sounded some fire alarms, saying we're sorry, but the law and precedent doesn't let us intervene in the day-to-day record keeping at the White House. But please do not take this court decision as any kind of affirmation of those record keeping practices. And Congress needs to take a look at this. Does it really want to give the president such unfettered authority? We think the archivist of the United States, who's a presidential appointee confirmed by Congress, should be setting the standards for record keeping at the White House, not the president by himself. We think the National Archives budget should be doubled, and it should be undertaking audits, not just sitting there waiting for the records to be dumped on it, but actually prowling about to check. We think the White House should have to report on its record systems publicly so that we can get the lifeguard whistle before it's too late and the records have already drowned or gone. We think that the law needs to give groups outside watchdogs like us a little more ability to get into court and get discovery about what's actually happening, about where those disappearing instant messages are and how much is being saved. So those things would put some teeth in the law. And maybe the next Congress will be more interested in holding a Biden presidency accountable than they've been willing to do with this Trump presidency.
We're talking to Tom Blanton, the director of the National Security Archive, and Richard Ovenden, director of the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford. Aaron comments on our Facebook page, "I'm surprised there isn't already one of those huge shredder trucks parked permanently outside the White House. I think they'll find it's a lot harder to destroy evidence than they think it is. I fully expect the Biden crew to find computers with smashed hard drives when they move into the White House." Well, we'll get into record preservation a bit more after the break. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Headspace. Life can be stressful, but 2020 has challenged even the most difficult times of life. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes. That's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations and an easy-to-use app. Need help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions. Go to headspace.com/1A for a free month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Since the 1980s, hip-hop and America's prisons have grown side by side.
And we're going to investigate this connection to see how it lifts us up and holds us down.
Hip-hop is talking about what we live, trying to live the American dream, failing at the American dream.
I'm Sydney Madden.
I'm Rodney Carmichael. Listen now to the Louder Than a Riot podcast from NPR Music,
where we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
This is 1A. When President Trump leaves office, what information about his administration will be saved for the history books and what will be lost? We're talking about it with Tom Blanton, the director of the National Security Archive, and Richard Ovenden, the director of the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford. Richard is also the author of Burning the Books, A History of the Deliberate Destruction of Knowledge. Now, perhaps the most famous incident of book burning happened at the Library of Alexandria in the 1980 premiere of his TV show Cosmos. Carl Sagan spoke about this legendary place.
If I could travel back into time, this is the place I would visit. The Library of Alexandria at its height 2,000 years ago. All the knowledge in the ancient world was once within these marble walls.
We'll talk about what you might call the modern Library of Alexandria, the internet, in a bit. But first, Richard, how accurate is this legend of the Library of Alexandria?
Well, Actually, I think it's really a myth. You know, there was certainly a great library at Alexandria, and it had enormous collections. All the ancient writers agree on that, although they fundamentally disagree on exactly how many books were kept in it. They weren't books like we know them today. They were scrolls of papyrus. But still, the ancient writers all knew that there was this great library. And in fact, some of them actually studied there. So Strabo, the geographer, for example, recorded the books that he consulted when he went to the Great Library of Alexandria. And there were other writers who were also the librarians there. But what really happened were a series of incidents where there were fires, because at least by the 4th or 5th centuries, the library had gone. Now, I don't think that any of the scholars who work in this field now think that there was a single incident where the library went up in flames and everything was lost. But actually, what happened were there were a series of smaller fires, one of them almost certainly the result of the kind of civil war between Caesar and Ptolemy. But others were actually really about the gradual decline of the library. And it's very interesting listening to Tom speaking a few minutes ago about the importance of funding the National Archives and Records Administration in the United States properly. And I couldn't agree more. I think what happened in Alexandria was a kind of similar process. Gradually, the Great Library stopped being funded by the rulers of Alexandria. And over a period of time, actually in their situation over centuries, it stopped having the level of support. It wasn't regarded so prominently in the state and in the kind of the royal, in the royal administration. And it began to have fewer staff to support it. So, we don't exactly know, but what we do know is that by the 4th and 5th centuries, it was gone. Mm. And that no record of it survives today. None of the collections have passed down to it. Some of the texts were copied, fortunately, and have come down to us through other routes. But I think it's that kind of underfunding and neglect that we should take as the great lesson of Alexandria. You know, they had, as Carl Sagan so kind of eloquently put it, you know, this astonishing achievement in civilization. But a few centuries later, it was gone. And that should be our warning sign. That's what we should take from the lesson of Alexandria, is that we must value libraries and archives in society, not just for the knowledge that they contain, but for the contribution they make to an open and democratic society.
Well, Tom, we've seen this shift from paper to digital. How has that changed the way the federal government keeps records?
Dramatic change. Imagine going from a vault, a file cabinet of paper, to what you could carry around the size of your thumb would hold what were the contents of the Library of Congress 10 or 20 years ago. So the thumb drive with, 10 terabytes, the storage capacity is extraordinary. And also the volume is extraordinary, so that in many ways, the task of an archivist decades ago was mainly about weeding out what was not useful or historically valuable or should be saved. And estimates are that only about 1-2% of the federal government's records from decades ago got saved on an ordinary basis. And today, with electronic systems, while on the one hand, they can be fragile. There's a famous weekend at the White House in the Reagan years where Oliver North of Iran-Contra notoriety spent the weekend deleting his emails one at a time. Unbeknownst to him, there was a backup tape that got saved, and so they were reconstructed. So there's a fragility to electronic records on the one hand. But on the other hand, that backup tape shows you the robustness of preservation in a digital age. You can restore those backup tapes. You can maintain them in multiple locations, whether on the cloud or on thumb drives or whatever.
Well, that actually leads to this.
Much more possibility.
This leads to this question from Steve in Atlanta, who says, "I wonder what steps archivists are taking to make sure electronic records endure. Hard drives from the 80s and 90s, for instance, are often degraded, or their contents cannot be read by any currently available software. The only records we know will last 500 years or longer are on good quality paper. What do we know about how the archives are adjusting to changes in digitization?"
That's a great question, and it goes to resources, I think, as Richard commented. He's been involved in all kinds of digital preservation initiatives in Europe and the UK, and what archivists have to do is migrate the records and the information from old media to new media. There was a fascinating case where some old dicta belts from the Eisenhower presidency were discovered decades later, but there was no machine that could actually read them, and they had to go back to the headquarters of the dicta belt company. I think it was in Indianapolis or somewhere. And there was an old machine under a glass dome in the lobby as a showpiece. And they cannibalized that machine in order to read the tapes and restore Eisenhower's voice. Think about that as an extraordinary record for history. So it's a challenge, a huge challenge. And that's where resources are of the essence. But I would say there are other professions, particularly the legal profession and corporations, that are much more on the cutting edge than we've allowed our government agencies to be because of this underfunding problem. And that, I think, there are some great technical solutions, even for saving those text messages if they're on a government smartphone. There are some technical ways to make sure those go into the formal record. But it's a huge and ongoing challenge.
Oh, Linda in Green Bay, Wisconsin emailed us, "Isn't it ironic that people in the Trump White House are using things like WhatsApp when they made Hillary's use of a personal email server a core part of their 2016 campaign?" Where does the Hillary Clinton email controversy fit into this conversation, Tom?
That's a great question from your listener, because we now have evidence of at least four or five leading Trump appointees, the president's daughter Ivanka, the education secretary DeVos, the veterans secretary Shulkin, all have been caught using personal email systems to carry out government business. And I guess the evident hypocrisy doesn't seem to bother folks in the administration, but it poses that larger question in the digital age. How do we make sure that what government does is adequately documented, is available both for historians, for legal, administrative, evidentiary proceedings, everything from your Social Security record or your military service record to the transcript of a head of state meeting? Those are all important, all need to be saved. And I think the Hillary email issue actually in part arose from how clunky the State Department systems were. They were not automatically saving emails. You couldn't go back and retrieve those emails easily. That's only been in the last 6 or 8 years that that's been in place. So she used a private server, I think, both for convenience and for legal control, so that if anybody came after it, she could and her lawyers could prevent that.
We're talking to Tom Blanton, the director of the National Security Archive, and Richard Ovenden, author of Burning the Books, A History of the Deliberate Destruction of Knowledge. We'll have more with them and with you right after this break. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Lauren Koh of Loco Kitchen went from pie-zaster.
It looked like a crime scene. All the berry juices were everywhere.
To pie master. She'll share tips based on years of baking delicious pies that are stunning works of art, too. Listen and subscribe to NPR's Life Kit.
This is 1A. And we're continuing our discussion of the data and information that each presidential administration generates and how they handle that information. And Tom, we got this comment from Michael, who emailed, "Since acts of foreign diplomacy may cross over many presidential terms, there is a need for secrecy perhaps for decades or even centuries. Where does the need for secrecy fit into the Presidential Records Act?"
It's not in the act itself. It's in a series. The need for secrecy is in a series of other rules and regulations that govern govern national security secrets, which is what the questioner is asking about. And those secrets, yes, possibly that there's a good reason for preserving, for keeping those things secret for decades. But the Presidential Records Act itself says 5 years after a president leaves office, the National Archives should begin making those records available to the public. 12 years is the rule for classified information or material, say, about Supreme Court nominees that would be a personal privacy matter. So, but the rules on national security secrets, I think you can see it in the famous transcript with the Ukrainian president that the Trump administration originally would have called that conversation, that transcript between Trump and Zelensky, a top secret document that would damage relations, but ultimately ordered it declassified because they thought it would actually make the president look good. And when you read it as an outsider, like a citizen or a historian, you look at this transcript and you wonder, well, that probably could have been released after a year or two. That was not something that should be tied up for 12 years under the Presidential Records Act or decades.
Richard, I'm curious, you know, we think about how we used to go to the library to look things up. Now we go to Google. What concerns do you have about big tech controlling so much of our access to knowledge?
Well, I have a huge concern about this, and I think we should all be worried about the kind of process that's happening across society generally about the transfer of responsibility, if you like, for keeping social knowledge. So the control over the distribution as well as the creation of information that the big tech companies have. If you think of the number of images that are uploaded to social media sites, the amount of messaging that goes on in messaging systems, commercial messaging systems like WhatsApp. If you think of the number of searches that are made on search engines every second. I mean, it's absolutely staggering. But what's even more staggering is that all of that information is being gathered and harvested, and profiles of each one of us, Tom and yourself and myself, are being built up every single day. And these profiles are then traded by the big tech companies. At first, this trading was done in order to commercialize online advertising so that we would have personalized ads based on our credit card spending, or the fact that we searched for, you know, hotels in Tunisia meant the next time we go to a newspaper website, all the adverts are about flights to Tunisia. So what we now increasingly know is that that process, or that ability to use those online profiles of all of our clicks on like on Facebook, every time we search for something on Google, all of that is because of what we know about Cambridge Analytica and Facebook was being used to target political campaigning. And that political campaigning was either targeting political advertising or identifying individuals who could be targeted for voter suppression or voter encouragement. And this is all happened very, very secretively, you know, because the big tech companies, what my colleague at Oxford, the great historian Timothy Gartnash, calls the private superpowers. These are organizations we know that are very difficult for governments to regulate. They operate over the entire globe. They have massive financial resources. And, they're really only accountable to their shareholders. Mm. And in many cases, they're even kind of privately owned, let alone by shareholders.
Well, Tom, we have just under a minute here, but I'm curious how you and your organization, how you're preparing for the end of the Trump presidency and trying to ensure that records from this presidency are, in fact, preserved.
Great question. We've been interviewing a lot of the career civil servants, because those are folks with as Richard was pointing to the need for morality in public life. These are folks who have a serious ethical system. They understand the calling and the legal requirements of the records laws. They understand that good functioning of government depends on knowing what you did before and why, and therefore records are essential for that. As Don McGahn told Trump, "I'm a lawyer, I take notes so I know what happened." Mm-hmm. And those folks are giving us some assurances, especially about the automated email systems. I think the other dynamic is we're in court on a couple of different cases where if there are credible allegations of a bonfire in the Rose Garden, we'll be able to get a court order to bring in some fire extinguishers.
That's Tom Blanton. He's the director of the National Security Archive, a nonprofit government watchdog group, and Richard Ovenden. He's the director of the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford and author of a new book called Burning the Books, A History of the Deliberate Destruction of Knowledge. Thanks to you both. And here's an idea from Calvin on Twitter. He says, incentivize it. If you don't get a 99% score on the Federal Records Act, you don't get a presidential library, or the library should be empty where the records should have been. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.